Hello everyone. Welcome to this 88th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. I'll be, BL can't be with us today, so I will be letting people in, so I'm kind of multitasking as I'm speaking. As you all know by now, this webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation webinars, then webinar series in progress, as shown here. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. So if you lost your link, your email link, just go to MoriaFederation.com and you'll notice up here in the upper left-hand corner are all the active webinar series. Okay. This month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott describes the work of, excuse me, of the hypnotist Carl Hansen. He's a Dutch hypnotist. He was so famous and so effective that there were a number of nations that would not let him do public demonstrations because they didn't believe in hypnotism and they didn't want anybody around that could actually do it. But anyway, this is Olcott's reflections on this hypnotist. Let me see, in terms of readers, like I said, I'm winging it today. So we'll start by asking you to raise your hands if you'd like to be a reader. And if that doesn't work, then I will, call on you. If you don't want to read, that's fine. You know, just let me know. And no problem with that. So let's see, I'm just going to go down the line here. Yeah, Scott.
Okay.
Thank you.
Speaking of hypnotism, recalls an evening at HPB's sitting room on Lansdowne Road when Carl Hansen, the Danish professional hypnotist, made some experiments of an edifying nature. He's one of the most successful practitioners in the world, and in fact, so successful have his demonstrations been that more than one government has forbidden him to give them in public. It was, I think, on the evening above referred to that one of the company present, Mrs. Bessant, was made seemed to the subject to have disappeared from the room. Although she stood directly in front of him and spoke to him, he seemed neither to see nor hear him, her.
Thanks, Scott. Barbara, can you read for us?
Yes.
Thank you.
She took from HPB's whist table a handkerchief and dangled it by one corner before the subject's eyes. But he did not see her hand holding it, though he did see the handkerchief and was much amused at its self-suspension in the air. Turning to HPB, he said, "Madam, you must be doing some magic, for I see a handkerchief out there with nothing to hold it up. What is it?" Mrs. Bessant then held against her back a playing card, drawn at random and face downward from a pack. And again, the subject saw it and not Mrs. Bessant. Her body was transparent to his psychical vision. This was an astounding experiment, for neither Mrs. Bessant nor any of the others in the room had knowledge of the value of the card until the subject called it out, and we each verified his accuracy. If Hansen had seen it first, then we might presume that it was a case of telepathy, but he did not. Let the materialist explain the phenomenon if he can.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay. We began our last session together by taking a look at the first creative hierarchy, which was actually introduced, knowledge of this hierarchy, as far as I know, and in theosophy anyway, was introduced by HPB. It was first described as the fiery lions and the lions of life, and is an expression of the constellation Leo. She then compares this hierarchy with the quote, upper Sephirothal triad, which is placed by the Kabbalists in the archetypal world. HPB then extends this triadal comparison to the three primordial gods of both the Shinto system, called the Koto Amatsu Kami, and symbolized by the Tomoe, which consists of three kama-shaped figures arranged in a circular pattern, and also with the Buddhist Trikaya, in both cases, the three-in-one. With the Buddhists, it symbolizes truth, bliss, and the emanation bodies of the Buddha. We then took a closer look at the primordial Shinto Trinity, which HPB calls an Arupa triad, through a creation story told by Omoikane, a god of wisdom and the son of the second personage of the Trinity. The story begins, when all was as yet chaos, Konton, three spiritual beings appeared on the stage of future creation. This is followed by the names of the three deities, which translated into English are divine monarch of the central heaven. That's like the Kether position in the tree of life. Let me turn my video on. Exalted imperial divine offspring of heaven. And then the feminine div, so that's the sonship, and that would be similar to the Chokma position, the Sephiroth, directly below and to the right of Kether. And then the feminine deity called simply offspring of the gods, which would be the Bina, the third Sephiroth, and the source of active intelligence and all manifestation proceeding from her. Next, in a further exploration of the spiritual triad, this time as it expresses itself in the Kabbalah, we took a look at the three primordial levels of existence called Ayin, Ayin Sof, and Ayin Sof Aur, which represent three progressive stages of the unmanifest, all standing above the highest of the 10 Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. HPB describes the highest of these as the absolute endless no thing, which uses the form of the one, the manifested heavenly man, the first cause, all in capitals, as its chariot to descend into and manifest through in the phenomenal world. Then finally, we took a look at teachings from the Chaldean Book of Numbers, which describes three levels of reality. And I think we took a look at this chart, and this takes us up to where we left off last time. So we'll start this session by rereading part of the, we were in the middle of this, so we'll reread this passage before going on. So let's see here for readers. Again, can we get a reader? about Jerry, would you be willing to read? Jerry Rosser? Are you in a position to read? Maybe not. Okay. Nadell, thank you.
In the book of Numbers, it is explained that Ain or Ain, Ior, is the only self-existent, whereas its death, Bythos or Buthon of the Gnostics, called Propator, is only periodical. The latter is Brahma as differentiated from Brahma or Parabrahm. It is the depth, the source of light, or Propator, which is the unmanifested logos or the abstract idea, and not Ein Sof, whose ray uses Adam Kadmon, or the manifested logos, the objective universe, male and female, as a chariot through which to manifest. But in the Zohar, we read the following incongruity. Senior.
Let me read that for you.
Yeah, okay.
Senior occultatus est et absconditus. Microprosopus manifestus est et non manifestus. Rosenroth Lieber Mysteri. Go ahead.
This is a fallacy, since microprosopus, or the microcosm, can only exist during its manifestations and is destroyed during the Mahapralayas. Rosenroth's Kabbalah is no guide, but very often a puzzle.
Thank you for that. Okay, so first, in the book of Numbers, it is explained that the Ian, En, or Ain, or Ior, is the only self-existent, whereas its depth, Bythos, or Buthon of the Gnostics, called Propator, is only periodical. So she's giving us a contrast between the ever self-existent one and its periodical manifestation in matter. So Ayin, also called En or Ior, it's essential circle, is here being contrasted with Bythos, also called Buthon and Propator, which only comes into existence during cyclic manifestation. The link between the two is Ain Sof Aur, this last radius here. Notice how it links with Kether, which would represent the unmanifest from the point of view of any material manifestation, but would be within the realm of cyclic causal, cyclic but causal, or causal but cyclic. Next, the latter is Brahma, as differentiated from Brahma or Parabrahm. It is the depth, the source of light, or Propator, which is the unmanifested logos or the abstract idea, and not Ein Sof, whose ray uses Adam Kadmon, or the manifested logos, the objective universe, male and female, as a chariot through which to manifest. So the latter being described here is the periodical Bythos, right? Which HPB here tells us is the source of the light of creation, as opposed to Parabrahm, the absolute. She makes a further point that the ray of Ein Sof, which is Ein Sof Aur, and which emanates from the point in the center of the circle, uses Adam Kadmon as a chariot through which to manifest. So in this phrase, HPB describes three levels, each with multiple names. So this was part of my review, but we'll go back over it because I think it's worthwhile to nail this down somewhat, at least. Don't think actually you can nail down the unmanifest, but the concept of it anyway. So at the highest level, we have Parbrahm, Brahma, without the circumflex accent over the A, and N, or Ayin. Three of the many names for the absolute, right? The second level includes the first cause, Brahma with the circumflex accent over the A, Bethos or Bhuthan, the depth, the source of light, and that's probably the best indicator of just what level we're looking at, also called Propator, and the original and eternal idea. Again, idea and source of light, all names for the unmanifested logos. And finally, Adam Kadmon, the manifesting chariot, and the male and female objective universe, all names for the manifested logos, the potential source of the ray sent forth by Ayin Sof, called by Kabbalist Ayin Sof Aur. Okay. So this is the point in the center of the circle, which when sent forth becomes the first, at first the diameter, then the cross within the circle, the latter a symbol for the manifested third logos. Any questions, thoughts or questions? So this takes us all the way back to the material we started with when studying the beginning stanzas of the Secret Doctrine, where she talks about this level of being and source and cause. Next. Yes, Barbara.
So I understand that the Kabbalistic system has a little different explanation than the absolute in the Secret Doctrine, that it's said to actually withdraw, to have room for intentionality. And the absolute in some systems sort of overflows or radiates, but doesn't necessarily put in intention with that radiation. So,
yeah, right, right. Yeah, the theosophical understanding is there's no intention. That comes into the nature of the first logos in theosophy. So you have the absolute, which mirrors itself into the universe. And then the first logos, is its nature is intention, but it doesn't, it's not a creator God. It doesn't express that intention. It's just the source of that intention. So it's the second logos is the Mula Prakriti, or the shining sea of substance, as they call it. These are brought together, and the symbol for that is the Vesica Pisces, also called the Mandorla. And the central portion of that, which is the Mandorla proper, is the sun, the S-O-N, sun. And from it, now you're looking at the creator aspect, and within it all creation emanates. And it's fascinating too, because there's all forms of geometry, all the geometrical figures, you know, triangle, square, pentagon, the six-sided figure, the septagon, and the eight-sided, they all emanate from the geometry that comes from the overlapping of those two circles. And so it's a perfect geometrical metaphor, still a metaphor for these higher realities. And there, as you said, I haven't done a deep study of the Kabbalistic belief system as it applies to each of these levels. What I have read just is not very helpful in the sense that, for instance, it describes Ein Sof in comparison to Ayin is causally conditioned towards in an abstract way towards the eventual purpose of manifestation, whereas Ayin Sof Aur is actually the beam that emanates from the central point of the circle. But I haven't read a deep philosophical any kind of teaching as to the nature of Ayin from the point of view of the Kabbalists, which would be, I'm sure, quite interesting, but I haven't done that. Thank you, Barbara. Anyone else? Okay. Okay. But in the Zohar, we read the following incongruity. I won't torture you with my Latin, which translates from Rosenros Liber Mysteri as the Ancient One is hidden and concealed. The Microprosopos is manifested and is not manifested, is manifested and is not manifested. Meaning that this is my interpretation anyway, that the Microprosopos or lesser face always exists as unmanifested potential. As such, it is the point in the center of the circle, which cyclically manifests as the perimeter of the circle, or out into the body of the circle would be one way of looking at that, by means of, for instance, the diameter of the cross and the swastika, which represent different stages of manifestation. However, HPB is not buying it. She says, this is a fallacy. This is a fallacy, since microprosopos, or the microcosm, can only exist during its manifestations and is destroyed during the Mahapralayas. Rosenroth's Kabbalah is no guide, but very often a puzzle. So the statement the microprosopos is manifested and not manifested, she's saying, is a fallacy, because we're here being told during the unmanifested stages called pralaya, the microprosopos is destroyed. That would be HPB's view, and so cannot be quote unquote not manifested. So she's taking exception with this Rosenroth's interpretation here. I think it's a kind of a fine semantical distinction, for it seems to me that the microprosopos's unmanifest state could be described as an ever-present potential, for without this potential point of emanation, from whence would the manifested realm issue? So you can see how you could make a case for either argument. This is right up there with how many angels on the head of a pin, you know. Okay, so next up, Keep the thoughts and the questions coming. It's always more interesting. Let me check my chat here. Okay. Magda.
Yes, could this be the problem wait a second, that the Ein is the senior occultatus, absconditus, that's always manifestus and non-manifestus. The second step, the Einsof
Let me go
is,
back there.
the Ein is absconditus, manifestus, and non-manifestus always. The Einsof is also always manifestus and unmanifestus. It's just only the Einsof hour, which Blavatsky said is during Pralayas, is not manifestus. Could that be that? Because I see three elements, and then all of a sudden, in that page, they become two.
Yeah, I
What
think
happened to the third one?
she doesn't, she wasn't going by this chart. She doesn't distinguish between Ayin and Ayin Sof. She often mixes the two. She'll call Ayin Sof the absolute in certain statements, and then other times she breaks them out. But I've never seen her actually describe the difference between those two. But to respond to what you just said, these two are never manifest. Ayin and Ayin Sof are never manifested. This is the source of the Ayin Sof Aur, is the source of the manifestation, but it's not the manifestation itself. You don't actually get into periodical manifestation until you get to the 10 sephira, the tree of life. So these are three different levels of unmanifest source, with the last being you could say the most causal levels of manifestation, though it itself doesn't manifest. What you said actually applies a lot to Kether, which can be considered both manifest and unmanifest. In fact, the three highest sephiroth are themselves not manifest. They're sources for the qualities that they represent. But from a higher perspective, yeah, they're manifest, because even the sources, even though they're not, they don't have forms as we understand them, they're still specific to, in terms of the causes of those forms. It all gets quite convoluted, all the more so because none of us have the ability to penetrate into these levels through our in for instance, in meditation. We're working on trying to gain soul awareness, which is way down the line. This is down in the like the fifth and sixth sephiroth. So it's pretty much philosophical distinctions, which I think exist in reality, but there's no way that we can directly tap into these understandings. Nonetheless, they're important, and very fascinating. Thank
Thank
you,
you.
Magda. Okay, so next up begins HPB's commentary on the B section. B section of the verse, which reads, as you can see here on the left, first the divine vehicle. And that's what the commentary is on. Yes, Martha.
I can read when you're ready, Francis.
Terrific. Thank you. Go ahead.
As in the Japanese system, in the Egyptian and every old cosmogony, at this divine flame, the one are lit the three descending groups. Having their potential being in the higher group, they now become distinct and separate entities. These are called the virgins of life, the great illusion, etc. And collectively, the six-pointed star. The latter is the symbol in almost every religion of the Logos as the first emanation. It is that of Vishnu in India, the chakra, the wheel, and the glyph of the Tetragrammaton, the he of the four letters, or metaphorically, the limbs of Microprosopos. In the Kabbalah, which are 10 and 6 respectively. The latter Kabbalists, however, especially the Christian mystics, have played sad havoc with this magnificent symbol. For the 10 limbs of the heavenly man are the 10 Sephiroth. But the first heavenly man is the unmanifested spirit of the universe and ought never to be degraded into Microprosopos, the lesser face or countenance, the prototype of man on the terrestrial plane. This, however, later on.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, first, as in the Japanese system, in the Egyptian, and every old cosmogony, at this divine flame, the One, are lit the three descending groups. Having their potential being in the higher group, they now become distinct and separate entities. It's an important paragraph, actually. That describes it pretty well. Actually, these systems, however, are not as straightforward as HPB here suggests, at least not in the exoterically published versions of these Japanese and Egyptian systems. In the Japanese system, a trinity of unmanifest gods emerged from the chaos with Ame no Minakanushi, chief among the three. But these three are not emanations from a higher, more noumenal being, at least not in the Shinto doctrine available to the public. Is there, in fact, a noumenal source for these three? If we accept the universality of the ageless wisdom, then yes, of course, there is. And it would seem that HPB was aware of this when she uses this as an example. And she may well have had information that is not available. But if it exists, it's definitely not reflected in outer Shinto doctrine. It starts with the Trinity, very much like, with the Kether Bina Chokma. I think they're very much related here, not at this level. That's what my take on it is. Of course, you know, you always have to do a deeper study to actually nail these things down for sure, but that's my take from what I read about them. As to the Egyptian system, it has multiple and varied expressions. In Heliopolis, that's this system, a case can be made for a noumenal transcendent Atum, who manifests in the highest group as Atum Ra, okay? And that's the only of these three principal groups from Egyptian mythology. This is the only one where you have this distinction, where you have a tomb at its own level, truly causal, and then a tomb Ra as the great solar source of manifestation. But in the Hermopolitan hierarchy, the highest gods are the Ogdoad, eight equal primordial deities representing chaos and the elements before creation. And these, to me, these guys are quite interesting. You have a series of pairs. You have Nun and Naunet, representative of the primeval waters, He and Hauhet, representing eternity, Kuk and Kauket, representing darkness, and Amun, notice the same similarity to Atum, Amun and Amunet, representing air or the hidden aspects of existence, So, you know, one could argue that esoterically, these are all aspects of one noumenal God being. And perhaps this is true, but if so, there's no record of a single synthesizing God that stands above or within the this Ogdoad, at least not in any extant Hermopolitan papyri. The highest God in the Memphite cosmogony, this is to me the most material of the hierarchies, is Ptah or Ptah, but he is clearly a creator God who conceived the world through thought and speech, not a noumenal first logos type being. In early Egyptian times, a primordial version of Typhon, who was associated with the Great Bear, was universally adored throughout Egypt until suddenly in the 20th dynasty, he fell from grace and became the personification of evil, which is another way of saying they completely lost touch with that particular source of spirit. So, you know, to get the nuances of these three, you would have to do a really deep dive. It really is interesting material because it's full of concepts that associate well with theosophy, especially the Egyptian stuff. Okay. Next, speaking of the first level of quote unquote distinct and separate entities, HPB says, these are called the virgins of life, the great illusion, etc., etc., and collectively the six-pointed star. So in theosophy, the virgins of life ultimately represent Mula Prakriti, undifferentiated cosmic substance in its highest forms, represented also by the circle with the diameter. The abstract essence of what later, through various differentiations, becomes the many forms in matter. They are collectively the great illusion at its highest level. Illusion because they represent the garment of spirit, not spirit itself. They also represent the highest possible use of the six-pointed star, which in this context represents spirit immersed in noumenal matter, or the two brought together by Fohad as an expression of manifestation of spirit in matter in manifestation. Next, the latter is the symbol in almost every religion of the Logos as the first emanation. The emanation represented by the down-pointing triangle. Next, it is that of Vishnu in India, the chakra or wheel, and the glyph of the tetragrammaton, the he of the four letters, or metaphorically, the limbs of Microprosopos in the Kabbalah, which are 10 and 6 respectively. So that's a packed sentence. So first of all, in Hinduism, the six-pointed star is called Shatkona. Vishnu, in his role as preserver and sustainer of the universe, embodies the balance and harmony represented by this symbol. In Kabbalistic thought, the hexagram symbolizes the interplay of the divine and the earthly in time and space, which is, you know, same idea as we have here with Vishnu, right? The interplay of the divine and the earthly in time and space, which is represented by the alpha and omega symbols shown here. The sideways anchor and the T represent the grounding aspect of the Tao cross, pictured at center. The Tao itself, we're told late in the second volume of the Sacred Doctrine, is formed from the figure seven and the Greek letter gamma, which is the symbol for life, and of life eternal, of earthly life, because gamma is a symbol of the earth, Gaia, and of life eternal, because the figure seven is a symbol of the same life linked with the divine. Any thoughts or questions about this or the six-pointed star? Finally, the glyph of the tetragrammaton, the he of the four letters, or metaphorically, the limbs of Microprosopos in the Kabbalah, which are 10 and 6 respectively. Okay, so he, that's H-E, of the four letters is the tetragrammaton. Here's how it relates to the 10 of the Microprosopos. And and the six of the six-pointed star. The yod represents the divine will. Okay, so what I meant by that was what I'm about to tell you is how it relates to the 10 of the Microprosopos of the six of the six-pointed star. First of all, the yod represents, that's this figure, represents the divine will, and is associated with the Sephiroth of Chokhmah, or wisdom. It is the divine spark of, or initial point of creation. In the hexagram, it corresponds to the central point where the upward and downward triangles intersect, symbolizing the unifying force that connects the divine and the material worlds. Hey, that's this figure, represents the divine understanding. And, you know, we're going through the tetragrammaton, right? So it starts yod, then he, and of the four letters. Represents divine understanding and is associated with the Sephiroth of Bina here. He is the divine breath of, or life force. In the hexagram, it corresponds to the top point of the upward triangle, symbolizing the upward movement towards the divine and spiritual realm. Vav, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, represents the connection between the divine and the material world. This is the third letter of the tetragrammaton, and is associated with the six Sephiroth, Kesed, Kevorah, Tefereth, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. Actually, I'm realizing that Chokhmah is actually pronounced Chokhmah, and I think Chesed is Kesed. So this symbol, this Vav letter, which is the third letter of the tetragrammaton, represents the form of the, or the body of the Microprosopos. But notice it doesn't include the densest materialized point. In the hexagram, it corresponds to the two lower points of the upward triangle and the So it corresponds to the two lower points of the upward triangle and the two upper points of the downward triangle, symbolizing the bridge between the spiritual and earthly realms. The final he represents the divine presence in the material world and associated with the lowest Sephiroth, the Malkut, which means kingdom. In the hexagram, it corresponds to the bottom point, not surprisingly, of the downward triangle, symbolizing the grounding of the divine energy in the physical realm. So, you know, when she says, the head, the four letters, the limb, or metaphorically, the limbs of the microprosopus in the Kabbalah, which are 10 and 6, respectively, that's what she means. That's the breakdown on that. Okay, any thoughts or questions? You guys getting some sense of what I'm talking about here? Yes, Barbara.
I'm not quite seeing the transition from the usual geometry of the Tetragrammaton to the sort of Star of David geometry.
Okay, here it is. Let me show you back here. Right here. It's in this. So, which is a figure used in the Kabbalah to represent the Tetragrammaton. Okay. And so you see the Tetragrammaton here, and then its various components. And so from that, then you can take it into the meaning of the, as they appear around this six-pointed star. And I haven't done a deeper study than that, Barbara. I think I'd have to get a funny hat and grow a long beard before I could tell you much more.
Okay.
Anyone else have any thoughts or questions? Yes, Marguerite.
Yeah, in my Golden Dawn days a while ago, we studied the Tetragrammaton, meaning the four-lettered word of God. Now, Keter was the first sephira, was ascribed to Yod, which means a finger or the hand of God. The Vav was Bina, and Hokman Bina, and that was the Vav. A Vav means a nail or something to fasten. Mm. So that which the hand of God pointed at or directed, it became fastened at this point. And then the Yate Vav goes from Gebura through Yesod, and that is... Vav is something that fastens.
Right.
So whatever was directed, Bina and Hokma, the hay means a window, which was interesting in our studies because it's something you can look in or something you can look out of. And then came from Gabor to your soul, Vav, and that was something that fastens. So it got nailed shut at this point. And the final hey, which had a like a diacritical mark over it, it was a final called hey final. So everything solidified itself in Malkut. Now Keter was the world of spirit. That's Keter. The Bina and Chokma and Bina in order, was the world of Bria. That's the archangelic world. And the Vav is the world of Yetzira. That's from Gabura through Yesod, and right. Malkut was actually the final, where everything was just nailed shut there. A window again, but it's nailed. So in other words, it's finalized.
Yeah, thank you for that additional info on it. It sounds like there's a difference in the system you learned here, right here, where we are now. Because you said that Yod was associated with Kether, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the hand or finger of God. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in this particular study, you know, it's associated with Chokma. And then you said that this figure was associated with which? With both Chokma and Vina?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Hay is associated with the archangelic world, Bria, that would be Chokmah and Bria. And then Gibora through Yesod is the Yetzirah right. world, right. and that is the Vav, and then Malkuth is the final.
Okay, so it's a little bit different. So where you start, where you start this, and you know, I could see an argument being made for both ways of seeing this. I really don't know enough to parse the fine points of, for instance, which would be more correct in terms of like associating Yod with either Kether or Chokmah. Yod tends to be a male orientation in some thoughts, in others it's pure spirit. So there you have the difference between Kether and Chokmah. So yeah, but again, thank you for that. It's cool that you studied that at one point. And then the lower hay has a different figure to it, huh? It has like an accent over the
Yes, it's to make it final. I'm sorry, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but it's always called hay final. It was a hay final.
Hay final, I see.
Yes,
and it's
because
it looks a little different.
Solidified. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's like the Brahma with and without the diacritical. It's a similar kind of a thing. Okay. Okay, just catching up. All right, so finally, the later Kabbalists, however, especially the Christian mystics, have played sad havoc with this magnificent symbol. And there's a footnote, which we'll explore in a minute. For the 10 limbs of the heavenly man are the 10 Sephiroth, but the first heavenly man is the unmanifested spirit of the universe. So the first Sephiroth should be representing that and ought never be degraded to the micro prosopos, the lesser face or countenance. And this is just in general Christianity, Christian mystics in general, have a more material interpretation of all the ancient symbols. So it doesn't surprise me that they would have Kether representing, you know, a manifested male potency of some sort. Let's see what else. Yeah, so for the 10 limbs of the heavenly man are the 10 Sephiroth. The first heavenly man is the unmanifested spirit of the universe, and ought never to be graded to the micro prosopos. Very important point. The lesser face or countenance, the prototype of man on the terrestrial plane. Of this, however, later on. Okay, Christian dogma has a tendency to materialize concepts that are meant to represent the unmanifest. And so it is with the three highest Sephiroth, Kabbalah, Tree of Life, which in its purest form represents unmanifest spirit and its division into the primordial or primary masculine and feminine duality, but still unmanifest energies. This trinity stands as the source of the microprosopas, which are the seven principles of humanity. So let's take a quick look at the two footnotes. First, which is referenced by the phrase, the magnificent symbol, shown here, states, indeed, the microprosopos, who is philosophically speaking quite distinct from the unmanifested eternal logos, quote, one with the Father, has been finally brought by centuries of incessant efforts of sophistry and paradoxes to be considered as one with Jehovah or the one living God, exclamation point. Whereas Jehovah is no better than Bina, a female, so forth. This fact cannot be too frequently impressed upon the reader. So Jehovah, HPB here informs us, is akin to the creator aspect of the third logos. This footnote from page 6 of the Secret Doctrine, first volume, gives further insight. Wait a minute, what happened? Oh, there it is. Could we get a reader for this, please? Let's see. Yes, Anne Veronica, go ahead.
Okay, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, my dog might be barking a bit. I'm sorry for that.
Not to worry.
We are told by the Western mathematicians and by some American Kabbalists that in the Kabbalah also, the value of the name Jehovah is that of the diameter of a circle. Add to this the fact that Jehovah is the third Sephiroth, Binah, a feminine word, and you have the key to the mystery. By certain Kabbalistic transformation, this name androgynous in the first chapter, of Genesis becomes in its transformation entirely masculine. Kenite and phallic, did I say that right?
Yeah.
The fact of choosing a deity among the pagan gods and making of it a special national god to call upon it as the one living God, the God of gods, and then proclaim this worship monotheistic, does not change into the one principle whose unity admits not of multiplication, change, or form. Especially in the case of the Priapic deity, a Jehovah, now demonstrated to be. Sorry, I butchered that a bit.
No, you're fine. Priapic, by the way, means relating to male sexuality, right? So, any questions about this? Okay. The second footnote referenced by the phrase man on the terrestrial plane says simply, the microprosopus is, as just said, the logos manifested, and of such there are many. There are many because the microprosopus is reborn in every root race, even in every subrace of every globe, because it's reborn through every cycle of manifestation. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please? Let's see here. Magda, could you read for us? Martha, didn't you just read?
Yes, I did.
Okay, let's see. Thank you, though. Magda, can you read for us?
Yes. The six-pointed star refers to the six forces or powers of nature, the six planes, principle, etc., all synthesized by the seventh or the central point in the star. All these, the upper and lower hierarchies included, emanate from the heavenly or celestial virgin, the great mother in all religions, the androgen, the Sephira Adam Katmon. In its unity, primordial light is the seventh or Hytus principle, Divi Prakriti, the light of the unmanifested logos. But in its differentiation, it becomes Fohat or the seven suns. The former is symbolized by the central point in the double triangle, the latter by the hexagon itself or the six limbs of the microposus, the seventh being Malkut, the bride of the Christian Kabbalists, or our earth. Hence the expressions, the first after the one is divine fire, the second fire and ether, the third is composed of fire, ether, and water, the fourth of fire, ether, water, and air. The one is not concerned with men bearing globes, but with the inner invisible spheres. The firstborn are the life, the heart, and the pulse of the universe. The second are its mind or consciousness, I, as said in the commentary.
Thank you, Magda. Okay, first, the sixth planet star refers to the six forces or powers of nature, the six planes, principles, et cetera, all synthesized by the seventh or the central point of the star. So six is universally the number of manifestation. The six emanates from the one. So you have here the six, the one, and together with the higher one form the sevenths, which are collectively the one or unity. This is perfectly symbolized by the six-pointed star, which demonstrates both as unity and as sixfold. The six forces or powers of nature emanate from the six highest manifested hierarchies. They are, and we're talking now about the energies of these hierarchies. And they are Parashakti, the supreme power, the highest form of energy, Kriya Shakti, materializing ideal, the power to produce external perceptible phenomenon, or the power of action. And while I'm reading this, think about the, you know, the Sephiroth, and which would be represented by which. You know, I would be putting Kether at this Parashakti place, supreme power. But you could make an argument for placing it in Chokma as well. Except for the fact that Kriya Shakti, materializing ideal, the power to produce external perceptible phenomena or the power of action, suggests Bina. But if we go by, I'm not sure who spoke, that put Kether at the top and then Bina, both Chokma and Bina together as a dual pair. And in that case, you could have Parashakti connected with Kether and Kriya Shakti connected with both of those Sephiroth. And then Jnana Shakti, force of mind, the power of knowledge. And then Mantrika Shakti, the word made flesh, speech, the power of sound or mantras. That's very much connected with the fourth, yeah, it is the fourth creative hierarchy. Ichcha Shakti, will to manifest, the power of will or desire. And finally, Kundalini Shakti, energy of matter itself, form, the universal life principle in nature, particularly lodged at the base of the human spine. So that's yet another way of looking at the six-pointed star, is the, you could say, repository of all the energies of manifestation synthesized by the central point, which, you know, if this showed the hierarchy, the higher hierarchies, the first unmanifest, which is Cancer, is very much oriented towards the manifestation of the lower seven. So it could be oriented towards that. The lowest hierarchy has no energy emanation. It's the, they're called the blinded or elemental lives, and they are used by the hierarchy directly above to build forms. Okay, any thoughts or questions about that? Crash course on the hierarchies. Okay, next. All these, the upper and lower hierarchies included, emanate from the heavenly or celestial virgin, the great mother in all religions, the androgyne, the Sephira Adam Kadmon. So ultimately, the celestial virgin is Mula Prakriti, the sea of shining substance from which the forms of all manifested beings are drawn. It's not a being as such. The creative hierarchies delineate seven levels of form life, as do the seven lower sephira, the tree of life, who have their source in Bina, the Kabbalistic celestial virgin. Next, in its unity, primordial light is the seventh or highest principle. Daivi Prakriti, the light of the unmanifested logos. But in its differentiation, it becomes Fohat, or the seven suns. This is great insight as to the origin of Fohat. So the Theosophical Glossary says, Daivi Prakriti is in fact the first veil or sheath or ethereal body surrounding the Logos, as Pradhana or Prakriti surrounds Purusha or Brahman in the Sankhya philosophy, and as on a scale incomparably more vast, keep that in mind, Mula Prakriti surrounds Parabrahman. As Daivi Prakriti, therefore, it is elemental matter, matter in its first and second stages, and matter in its first and second stages of its evolution. Okay, so Daiva Prakriti doesn't actually become Fohat, but rather provides the substantive aspect on which Fohat works, because Fohat requires this a duality to function, as described in this passage from De Perucker's Occult Glossary. Can we get a reader for this? I prefer raised hands, but I will start looking here. How about you, Ben? Are you willing to read?
Here it goes.
Thank you.
When Daiva Prakriti has reached a certain state or condition of evolutionary manifestation, we may properly speak of it under the Tibetan term Fohat. Although Fohat is the energizing power working in and upon manifested Daiva Prakriti, or primordial substance, as the rider rides the steed, it is the cosmic intelligence, or cosmic monad, as Pythagoras would say, working through Daivi Prakriti and its differentiated energy called Fohat, which is the guiding and controlling principle, not only of the cosmos, but in every one of the subordinate elements and beings of the hosts of multitudes of them infilling the cosmos. The heart or essence of the sun is Daivi Prakriti working as itself, and also in its manifestation called Fohat. But through the Daivi Prakriti and Fohatic aspect, if it runs the all-permanent and directive intelligence of the solar divinity. The student should never make the mistake, however, of divorcing this guiding solar intelligence from its veils or vehicles, one of the highest of which is Daivi Prakriti Fohat.
Thank you, Ben. Okay. Any questions about this, the distinction between these two principles, Daivi Prakriti and Fohat? It's another way of seeing these source levels. You know, I would associate it, for instance, with Ein Sof, Sof Aur, right? That emanating principle. That would be the Daivi Prakriti. And then Fohat begins its work at within the 10 sephira of the Tree of Life. That would be just one way of equating two systems. Okay, next. The former is symbolized by the central point in the double triangle. Yeah, six-pointed star. The latter by the hexagon itself, or the six limbs of the Microprosopis, the seventh being Malkuth, the bride of the Christian Kabbalist, or our Earth. So the six-pointed star represents the sixfold manifestation of substance. And that would be the Fohatic association, also represented by the fourth through ninth sephira. There are actually two seventh points. The first of these is Bina, the third sephiroth, and the source of the form aspect. That would be the Daivi Prakriti aspect, represented by the central point at the six-pointed star. The other and lower seventh point is Malkuth, called the bride of the Christian Kabbalists, because it represents the dense physical plane. The feminine always metaphorically representing the form aspect compared to the male spirit aspect. Any thoughts about that? Questions? Okay, hopefully, you know, we're getting some idea of how some of the deeper implications of the six-pointed star here. She's given us now a few ways of seeing it, interpreting it. Okay, next, hence the expressions. The first after the one is divine fire. The second, fire and ether. The third is composed of fire, ether, and water. The fourth, of fire, ether, water, and air. The one is not concerned with man-bearing globes, but with the inner invisible spheres. Quote, the firstborn are the life, the heart and pulse of the universe. The second are its mind or consciousness, as said in the commentary. So all this is old commentary. So this old commentary describes the elemental quality of the tree of life. Let's take a look at each segment. The first after the one is divine fire, refers to chokma, or kokma, I think. Somebody brought this to my attention. I think it's kokma. Yeah, this is associated with fire and dynamic energy, whereas Kether, the one, you know, this, because this is the first after the one is pure being, as well as the potential source of all. I should say pure being with the intention, carrying the intention of manifestation. Kokma is the first manifestation of that potential, representing divine wisdom and creativity. Kether symbolizes the unmanifest and the infinite, while Kokma represents the dynamic, expansive energy that initiates creation. This first after the one, quote unquote, is also represented by the Leo-ruled first creative hierarchy called the Divine Flames and the Lions of Life. The second, fire and ether, refers to Bhitna, which is exoterically associated with water, but esoterically with ether. This Sephiroth represents divine understanding and the ability to comprehend and process wisdom. That's the association between Kokma and Bina. As the Sephiroth of ether, spelled with an A-E, not just an E, Bina provides noumenal form and structure to the creative impulses of Kokma. So again, we have a sense of the relationship between them. I'll repeat that. Provides noumenal form, still noumenal, but the form and structure to the creative impulses emanating from Kokma. The second after the one celestial order is also represented by the Virgo ruled second creative hierarchy called the Bright Crested and the Divine Builders. You can see the association. The third after Kether is composed of fire, ether, and water. It refers to Kesed, which represents loving kindness, mercy, and benevolence. It embodies the outpouring of divine love and compassion. Kesed is often linked to the element of water, symbolizing the fluid and nurturing qualities of love wisdom. This would be the waters of life pouring forth for thirsty men. The fourth of fire, ether, water, and air refers to Tifereth, which is linked to the element of air, symbolizing clarity, balance, and the breath of life that sustains all existence. As the central Sephirah, Tifereth serves as the mediator and integrator of the higher and lower Sephirah, connecting the divine with the manifest world, and thus stands in the position of the soul. The statement, the one is not concerned with the man-bearing globes, but with the inner invisible spheres, refers to Kether, the highest Sephiroth. The inner invisible spheres are the globes of the inner rounds. So this is, HPB is here suggesting that this is the concern of the Kether. And finally, the firstborn are the life, the heart, and pulse of the universe. The second are its mind or consciousness, refers to Kokma, the firstborn, which represents the life aspect, and Bina, the second, which represents the feminine active intelligence. Okay, so hopefully you're getting a little feel for how these Sephiroth interrelate and their essential meaning. Okay, let's take a quick look at the two footnotes in this old commentary. The first, referenced by the term fire, ether, water, and air, simply says these elements of fire, air, etc. are not our component elements, I think. By this point in our studies, we know that the elements described are not those that manifest in the lower three subplanes of this physical plane, but it doesn't hurt to be reminded. They have something of the quality, but these lower manifested elements are a shadow of the noumenal qualities that are found in the higher noumenal elemental world. The second footnote, referenced by the term its mind or consciousness, states, this consciousness has no relation to our consciousness. The consciousness of the one manifested, if not absolute, is still unconditioned. Mahat, the universal mind, is the first production of the Brahma creator, but also of the Pradhana, undifferentiated matter. So human consciousness is born from the overshadowing by the soul, whereas the consciousness described in this old commentary is Mahat, which is cosmic mind or intelligence, the basis and fundamental cause of the intelligent operations in and of nature considered as an organism and emanating from the mental plane rather than the cosmic mental plane. Yes, Nadell.
Would Pradhana undifferentiated matter be the same as Mula Prakriti?
No, it's a I couldn't tell you the distinction, but it's because earlier she said at an inconceivably higher level, it's mula prakriti, and she had given us the example of pradhana for the virgin mother, right? And then she said it in an inconceivably higher level. So, for instance, pradhana could be atmak in quality, which is a unity of the source of substance for the lower five subplanes, right? Or even possibly logoic, the logoic plane, you know, the plane of Adi could be considered pradhanic, whereas mula prakriti would be the cosmic source of that undifferentiated matter. You know, again, because we can't, we have no way of actually perceiving the difference. It's, you know, like what I want to do now is go to the Theosophical Glossary and read very carefully those two definitions. But I'm not sure that it would actually give us any real understanding of the sense, except for to say the pradhana, if I was going to guess, would be a high level within the cosmic physical etheric plane, whereas the mula prakriti is a fundamental cosmic source of all matter. Yeah, that's as good as I can do.
Okay.
Could we get a reader for this? Please, let's see here. Marguerite, could you read?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mahat. Speak up. Mahat, Sanskrit Mahat, from the verbal root ma, to be great. Eternal in its essence and periodical in its manifestations, Mahat combines the ideal plans and prototypes of all beings and things in the manifest objective or unsubjective world. In other sense, it is the entire aggregate of the Dayani Shahanic host, and therefore the source of the active organic cosmic intelligence, controlling and directing the operations of Fohat. It is likewise the direct source of the Manasaputras, a class of the Dayani Chokhanic or Hokhanic host. In Brahmanical philosophy, Mahat is the father, mother of Manas. In Sankhya philosophy, it corresponds to cosmic Buddhi or Maha Buddhi and is called the first of the seven prakritis or productive creation, the other six being Ahamkara and the five Tanmatras.
Okay, so the takeaway is that Mahat is a cosmic principle in universal and its activities, universal or cosmic active intelligence, whereas Manas is relates to the human soul, mind, and it takes place on the systemic mental plane. That's the, you know, that's one way of understanding the difference. There's certainly more to it than that. Because there's an all-pervading quality to Mahat that animates all sentient life. Okay, I think we're going to pull the plug here just a couple of minutes early because we're going to be getting into this whole next section, which is actually a commentary on a new part of the verse. So I think this is a natural ending point. Do you have any last thoughts, questions about this? Appreciate you hanging in there. This isn't a particularly easy subject matter, but I think it pays one's attentive and patience, you know, to deal with this. Yes, Martha.
I just would like to make a general observation how much more deeply the earlier civilizations were concerned with God itself. That
isn't true.
It's so deeply responsive to what they saw and where they lived about that inner nature of God. And it makes me think of the unfolding of God itself, beginning with its first expression of manifestation in relation to the triadic movement of 3-2-1. So it's not, I know it's not terribly erudite, but I something bigger than the information is informing what you're doing.
The ancient mystery schools, there was a tremendous division between, in terms of education, you know, there was still the great masses that did not understand the philosophy that was given to the elite in the mystery schools. And by elite, I don't mean necessarily the ruling class or the rich or anything like that, but just those who were prepared and could take advantage, you know, of the information given. And that's the version of what, of the information that was given out at that time. That's the version that we tend to read about, you know. There were, there was a much simplified version for the masses in all the cultures around the Mediterranean, you know. But they had at their core a much deeper philosophy than the religions of today, that's for sure. Yes, Nadal.
I just wonder, given how we've grown up in this culture, that's pretty much an intellectual culture, you know, we have, you know, with universal education, etc. I suspect that we don't really have much of a sense of what we were 1,000 years ago, you know, in terms of how we thought, or if we thought, or what our whole orientation was. It just seems it was probably so different.
I agree. Yeah. It's, you know, it's even really hard to imagine the 18th century, for instance, you know, let alone 1,000 years ago. Yeah. It's one of the things that's happened is the shift to belief in science, and that has, for the intelligent human being on Earth, you know, the great majority has made science their central core belief, and has made agnostics out of, you know, a great number of people. You know, but there is a resurgence underway of what you might call intelligent spirituality. Yes, Magda?
Yes, I think we need to remember always that in the ancient mystery times, whether it was Hebrew or Egypt or Persia, we had completely different bodies. So the ways that were connected with the spiritual realms was totally different, and progressively the etheric body became always more and more attached to our physical body. So that's why gotten to the point of the fourth sub-race, the Christ had to come on the Golgotha event to bring down a measure of different way of contacting it, because otherwise man would have been lost and totally trenched off from the divine realm without being able to communicate it. And that's why now we need to learn how the ancient ways were, but we need to follow the science, the spiritual science methods of concentrations and all the DKs or Steiner's concentration methods to get ready for the initiations in the modern way, in this Rossabre's way. So,
yeah, well said. That's really well said, Magda. Exactly. We just can't know the subtlety of change in the equipment that was used by those, for instance, who attended the mystery schools and all around the Mediterranean, you know, Greece, Egypt, the Hebrew, and all the way up into the, you know, the Celts and the Druids and the Norse all had their own deeply significant mystery schools, you know, in Persia and India, you know, and we just can no longer, all we have are the writings, you know, that we can, and there are many cases extraordinarily so profound, in fact, that the ageless wisdom is our current version of it, at least, is drawn from those materials. At least that was true until HPB came along and reinstated a more direct link, and theosophy was born. So, okay, you all, appreciate you joining, and we'll catch up with you next time, which I think the next treatise on cosmic fire is the 28th, and that's the next one in my series. The first Sunday of the month will be the next Secret Teachings of All Ages, and then we'll go from there. So thank you all, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.